I'm Connor Good.
I'm Kyle Turner.
And this is Media Query, a podcast here to queer the conversation between TV, film, and all the things. Each episode, we ask our stories and storytellers one question to blend up our culture and make our discussion just a little more fluid. So, Kyle, I'm feeling kind of bad this week.
I'm sorry.
I feel bad because we promised people that we would be talking about superheroes this podcast, but we're not. and we're a little late.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. But we will definitely get to the superhero talk. Yeah. One of the reasons we're not doing the superhero episode this week is because we're trying to get a guest to be on that podcast, and that's going to take a little work. But we will definitely get to that. Also, I've kind of heard some not so great things about the Daredevil Netflix series. And I think it might be best to even like wait for Avengers to talk about it, but we'll see.
Does that mean I have to see that too?
Yeah. Means I have to see. That means I have to watch the first Avengers. I'm that out of touch with mainstream culture. It's going to be an ordeal.
The first one's fine. It is entertaining.
Yeah, I hear so. And I really like Joss Whedon most of the time. So I'll, you know, it's just superheroes. Sorry, everyone. I'm already, if you don't already know my opinion of superhero films in general, you can probably tell by the tone of my voice, which is kind of what we do here at Media Query.
Yeah, the disdain is just oozing out of every pore.
But actually, in lieu of that, we would love if listeners could send us links to anything, any pieces, articles, videos that they think would be relevant to our superhero talk about queerness and superheroes. And they can do that by sending links to mediaquery.tumblr.com, which is our Tumblr, our feedback Tumblr.
Woo!
Yay, it's up! And if I do say so myself, it's beautiful.
It is gorgeous.
It's really pretty. So go ingest that with your eyeballs.
Not as pretty as Connor's face, but almost, you know.
Why, thank you, Kyle. But now I get to use a different tone of voice, not talking about superheroes, and I get to use a really excited tone of voice because we're talking about Mad Men today. Yay! So if you forgive my vamping, they cheat, they lie, they smoke, they fuck, they're mad, and we get to watch. Of course, I'm talking about the characters of the TV show, guess what? Mad Men. But let us be clear, we're not just talking about the men. Sure, there's Don, Roger, Pete, Ken, and Mr. Potato Head, previously known as Harold. But there's also Peggy, Joan, Betty, Rachel, Midge, Don, and yes, even Meredith. Surprise, there's an airplane here to see you. I just had to put that in at some point. Though for being a show that renders even the idea of women silent in its title, Mad Men seems entirely interested in the complexities of gender, but particularly in how we as an audience see those gender dynamics on screen. And of course, when we start talking about gender, what do we start inevitably talking about? Something that Kyle and I would say we talk about a lot and know pretty well, the idea of gaze. The heterosexual male gaze, usually, but it's also important to remember as audience members that there is more than one type of gaze. So with that in mind, today's media query is this. What brand of gaze is Mad Men selling?
So the brand of gaze that Mad Men is selling is an interesting question because it seems to oscillate between many gazes throughout the show. It exists from many characters' point of view. Like, my favorite example is when it's employing the female gaze, the heterosexual female gaze, and the male gaze within the same scene, which is a scene that Connor pointed out to me when he was spending 6 months trying to convince me to watch the show. And it's in episode 2, Ladies' Room of season 1, and they are trying out, Joan has ushered in some ladies to try out some lipstick. And behind a two-way mirror are the men, kind of watching the goings-on and kind of leering at them. At one point, Joan bends over a desk, and the camera pans up her body, but she turns around and looks directly in the eye of the camera as if to look directly at the audience looking at her. And my other favorite scene is in the same episode, I think, when Peggy has just come from a lunch date with, who is it again?
Ken? Or are not you talking him. About... No. You're talking about in Ladies' Room. That's...
Yeah.
What you're, the episode you're talking about is not Ladies' Room with the two-way glass. But in Ladies' Room, she has lunch with Paul.
Yes, it is.
The two-way glass is not in Ladies' Room.
No? Okay.
That's further in the season. We don't have to get into disputes about Mad Men, like, continuity. It's in the first season.
Because Connor will win. Well, then the one that I'm talking about in Ladies' Room is when Peggy has just come from lunch and with someone, and she thinks that they're just being nice, but he starts to hit on her, and she is not a fan of that. She's new on the job, and Joan comes and says and tells her, that's basically how you're going to be treated, so you might as well get used to it.
Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to be the dessert, and is what she says.
She doesn't. Peggy. Yeah, she doesn't want to be the dessert. When it, and so after that, an entire montage that's like 45 seconds long of men walk by her and look directly into the camera, and it's as if the audience is watching. It's as if the audience is being gazed at, which I think is really, really fascinating. And I think that actually is really relevant to how it comes back to the first episode of 7B. Severance, because should we include?
We are not 7B? Calling it 7B. We are going to call it the final season, part two, if we need to. But AMC is the just like whatever. Yes, the final season.
So in the first episode of 7B, Joan and Peggy are trying to make a deal with McCann. They're trying to make a deal with McCann so that they can sell hosiery and Macy's in department stores, and Joan is getting sexually harassed during this meeting, and by the three men that they're meeting with. After the meeting is over, they go into the elevator, and Peggy basically slut shames Joan and says, "If you didn't dress that way, you wouldn't get sexually harassed."
Yeah, that was
harassed.
A fascinating scene.
And Joan is like, "Dress like what?" And I think that's very interesting because her remark after is, because I don't look like you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is I believe that is a callback to Ladies' Room.
And the first conversation that they have and their whole like dynamic in the very beginning is all about how Joan is like coaching Peggy to become something like Joan, to become like more of how Joan runs her job, how she's learned, you know, how she says, you know, go home, get a paper bag, cut some holes in it, and put it on and really evaluate your strengths, your assets. There's such an interesting parallel there. And their whole relationship. God, we are going to be dealing with so many tangents in this episode because I just love this show so much. We are going to have to really reel it in, Kyle, okay? Can we promise real quick? We're going to do our best to reel it in.
I can't promise.
So I want to go back to what you mentioned about Joan in the episode Babylon. That's the episode you were referring to with the two-way glass. She knows about the two-way glass. She knows who's behind it. And yes, there is this really fascinating moment where she basically is looking directly at the audience. Is the audience kind of being a proxy for the men in that room behind the two-way glass? But it is of note that Joan is, and this is part of her character and how her character functions in the show and what they're exploring with the character, is still using, she's not objectifying herself sexually, but she's still using her sexuality in order to defy the gaze. Whereas in that episode, there's a great example of not doing that and still defying gaze, and it's Peggy. It's how... at one point, Paul says something along the lines of, look at that pretty thing over there. I wonder what she's thinking. And he can't own her, essentially. And no one knows what she's thinking. And what she's thinking is the best line of copy for this lipstick company that all the women are in that room testing for. And no one expects it. And it comes out of nowhere. And that, I think, Peggy is kind of... Sorry?
Make your mark.
Yeah, a basket full of kisses is what she's thinking of. I think Make Your Mark is a different one at some point. But yeah, she eventually, this is what becomes her first job at this company. But I'm really fascinated in gays and Mad Men. Yes, in the gender aspect of it, it really seems to fluctuate and go all over the place. And I'm really interested in what you brought up about it really calls attention to the audience's gaze and things, not just the characters, the gender of the gaze, but the audience as a temporal subject in a different, I hesitate to say time period, but a different metaphysical space, witnessing this drama unfold. The scene you brought up about Piggy, where it's the slow motion, her watching all these men watching her. So many of those sequences, and they're everywhere in this show, everywhere. I would argue that the scene that you brought up about that's in Severance in season 7 with the McCann men in the room who are being such dicks, is in some way a scene of gaze on them, and a scene of ridicule on them. And so many of these scenes play out in that way, as if, yeah, we may be looking at Peggy and we may be seeing Peggy through the eyes of people who are making fun of her weight, like at the end of season 1. But we're actually gazing the men there because of them just being awful. And we're gazing their insecurities, and then they project them. I should shut up because I'm just going to keep talking forever. Yeah, you should just respond to something in that, and then I'll say something else.
I guess I will say that I feel like what I like about Mad Men when I first started it was that it was the kind of show that was able to depict terrible people doing gross things and not indulge in the grossness of what these people were doing by employing techniques where characters would defy the gaze or subvert it. Again, what interests me about that Peggy scene where all the men are looking at her is particularly this idea that Molly Haskell's definition of the male of the hetero female gaze is the male gaze being caught, of catching them red-handed, mm-hmm. essentially. And I think I would argue that it isn't as strong as the series goes on in terms of being able to critique but avoid being gross in its critique. I think it's from time to time does kind of indulge in fetishizing aspects of different characters' lifestyles, but I think that it fluctuates from mm-hmm. season to season, from episode to episode. What kind of worried me about Severance, this mm-hmm. first episode from the final season, you're gonna say.
Go ahead.
is the camera panning up and down this model wearing a chinchilla coat. But I think it doesn't excuse the gaze, but I do think it does make it a little bit more interesting, is that Peggy Lee's Is That All There Is plays as that is going on. And I think having Don look at her as well as all the other men in the room, which it cuts and it reveals that there are other men in the room.
Which is almost a great kind of like cut there. It's a great edit.
I think it's almost, it is still indulging it in that idea of objectifying, but I think it also calls out this idea that what are you looking at? You're just looking at a hollow shell.
I agree.
It may be beautiful, but that's all there is, as mm-hmm. the song goes. There's nothing else really to it, especially when she exists to audition for a campaign where she is just a shell advertising something else, selling something else.
I totally agree with that, that the slipping into supporting the thing it wants to explore, or that it has explored, maybe not necessarily wants to explore, but from the audience perspective has definitely explored really well. That's definitely, it's deteriorated a little bit, specifically in season 7. I would specifically point to season 7, the premiere. There is a slow motion, I'm talking about season 7, part 1, I guess. The premiere, there's like a slow motion, like very like we're in LA, like you're watching an ad when Don arrives and sees Megan. And I think Megan's getting out of a car or something like that. And yeah, as soon as this premiere started, of season 7, part 2 of Severance, I was like, oh, okay, we're doing this. I was a little worried about it. And honestly, the whole episode has that feeling of not really exploring as much as it has in the past and challenging what it has in the past. But yes, I do agree with you. There is this sense, and I think it also comes off in John Hamm's performance and the way he delivers those lines of where he's telling her what to do. It's having a thrill, but it's also, I think, really exploring it at the same time in more nuanced ways than other shows would. But yeah, I still think it's concerning. But the thing that really, really, really fascinates me about the show is this idea of who's gazing who, but not just like in the show, because we're exploring people gazing other people. And then we also gaze other people. But sometimes I think the show is gazing us in a way. There's this really great paper by Maurice Yakawar. It's called Suggestive Silence in Season 1. And it's actually in the, just a book called Mad Men, literally a book called Mad Men, edited by Gary Edgerton. But in this paper, there's this really fantastic idea that Yakawar has about silence and how silence operates in the show Mad Men, as a way of not only subverting the characters, but subverting the viewer. So we have, Mad Men is a show that, unlike most other shows, or if anything has pioneered it, like unlike most other shows, this idea of scenes where we're just with the psychological cliffhanger, where we're just with one character as a character is taking a drink or smoking a cigarette and staring off. And we're in silence with that character. If it's not just a scene, it's a moment. And we get this a lot with Don specifically, we get it with a lot of other characters. But what it allows is it allows us to see this character at their most vulnerable, at their most personal, at their most intimate. And what it does is there's kind of this moment where the idea that Yakawar has in his paper is based off us feeling superior to these characters. And I think with this silence that we feel as if, despite the fact that they're operating the way they are, we still know, you know, how the Vietnam War ends. We still know that blank company goes bankrupt. We still know that this bad shit happens. We still, you know, that we know all these things are going to happen in this world. And we have some kind of authority over them. And it comes out in these moments of silence, of vulnerability. But at the same time, there's a twist in that silence where because we see how absurd it is that the Drapers just pull their picnic blanket and leave all the trash there and the food there just on the grass, that we have the exact same examples in our own lives, and that in some way someone else might be watching us in our moments of silence and not and seeing how absurd we are at all these stupid things that we're doing and don't realize what we're doing, these social norms. And I find that to be a fantastic way of viewing the show and of understanding the show. There's a lot that's been written about materialist mise-en-scene in the show, in that it's so wrapped up, and some have said that the show is maniacal in its attention to detail, but not just historical accuracy as much as just how everything is very specific in it. Its looks, we all know what the lamp looks like in Don's office. We all know what the, that triptych of like giraffes in Pete and Trudy's old apartment. Do you remember that? Like, we know all those very specific things. Like, we know in Lane Price's office. Yeah, the chip and dip. We know that it's very wrapped up in its objects and its historical specificity and its world specificity, that maybe to a point that in materialist mise-en-scene, the characters take on the same role as objects. And then what we have is we don't just have women being objectified. We have all characters serving as objects that we're gazing. And I would argue that a lot of what makes Don's character so special is that we're gazing Don, that we're seeing him at his most vulnerable.
And we're judging him. I mean,
absolutely.
There's a great essay by Vikram Murthy on the AV Club that argues that Don is not an anti-hero. He's just a vulnerable, broken person like everyone else. And he doesn't have the upper hand over the audience in any way other than the fact that he has money. But he is just trying to get over the same hurdles of everyday life, of trying to be himself, of trying to allow himself to be vulnerable as everyone else is, and the people who are watching. And because we are not inclined to recognize that in ourselves, we try to we deal with it and then try to push it away, I would argue, it makes judging him all the more interesting and all the more one is much more inclined to do so because he's a fictional character. Also, what I think is interesting is when I had originally watched Mad Men shortly after the first season premiered, when it was available from Netflix as a disc, I had just watched the first few episodes and I found it interesting but kind of slow, and that was when I was a naive little child. Never really continued, but after it's made such a cultural impact and I was told to watch it by Connor primarily, I was skeptical because of the crisis of masculinity arc that is permeating a lot of television shows, this idea of the anti-hero, yada yada yada. It just was not interesting to me. So what I like about Mad Men is that it is not about the crisis of masculinity exactly. Its least interesting characters to me are its male characters. I find its female characters way more compelling.
And I agree.
And I also don't consider Don necessarily a quote-unquote male character. I think he is fluid in his way of trying to parse out who he is as a person, parsing out his identity, especially after the, I think, what is the episode? Which one is the one where we see him get raped?
The Crash.
The Crash. I think The Crash is very much indicative of all the trauma that he has to constantly go through in terms of trying to construct this idea of being a masculine male character. I think that's fascinating.
And that is a woefully underrated episode in understanding the whole scope of the show.
I think it's pretty well received within the critical community.
Yeah, but I don't think we talk about it as much as like that that episode holds the whole nexus of the show. Despite the fact that you have that like really like bad wig job with the young Don Draper. But anyways, I want to respond to that anti-hero piece that you're referencing, which I read as well, and we'll link in the show notes. But I found that piece so refreshing because for such a long time, I have said, you know, he's an anti-hero, and it's always felt like, is he an anti-hero? Like subconsciously in the back of my head, I've had that. And having someone like write that piece was so important. I was having a discussion with my roommate the other night just about how there's something about the show in understanding. She was watching Waterloo for the first time, which I think is one of the best episodes of the entire show. And it's where Peggy gives her speech, and it's the moon landing, and it's that really, really fantastic episode. But the thing about that episode and this whole final season so far has really been that it's shifted towards an idea of redemption and optimism, and also challenging the ideologies deep within the identities of these characters.
And deep within their culture.
And the thing about the show that to me makes it so resonant is this is the most cliche thing that anyone could ever say about loving a TV show. These characters are so real. And I mean that is a big thing to say, I think. You have to step back when you say that and not be just like, I love this show because the characters are so real. I don't think there's been a show that's been able to ride the line of, we do bad things, but you also care about us in a way that's lasted. It's for me personally, I know this is a really personal thing. This is a very phenomenological thing to talk about, a personal interaction with the text. But I haven't had an experience like Mad Men. And having that piece written about how Don's not an anti-hero, Don is a complex being that is accurate to life. He represents all of us in that he's done all these things that he regrets. He feels like he's living a lie, and he's dealing with this deep existential crisis that is unlike what you've seen with Tony Soprano, where Tony just is dealing with a more overt idea of what's bad and what's good, and how far am I willing to go, and what do I care about? Mm-hmm. Don is dealing with the more relatable and accessible, still huge crisis, but still it's relatable and accessible.
I wish I have a little bit of a regret because I binge watched the show over the course of.
Yeah, I told you to watch one a day.
Connor told me to watch one a day, but I didn't listen to him because I just loved watching it. And I'd like to go back and watch all of it again because there's an essay that I would like to write, and I have it titled in my head because I'm a bad person. It's called.
You do that before you write pieces, don't you?
I either do it before I write pieces, and that's what sparks it, or I write the piece and. I don't know, half hour to an hour, and then I spend another hour trying to think of a good title. But anyway, I would call it Men Behaving Madly. Why the...
Give me your subtitle. Sorry, I laughed through that.
Don Draper and the Uselessness of the Binary of Good and Bad.
Great.
Yeah, because a lot of people are inclined to call him either a good person or a bad person. And I think... Mad Men reveals that there really is no such thing necessarily, especially dealing with everyday people. They do bad things, they do good things. They are struggling with who they are, and that is just it exists on a spectrum.
That's the case with all of the characters. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them. I mean, there's Harry, but there's also like pieces of Harry that like Yeah, and Pete is, like, sad when you break it down. His relationships that he's had with his parents, everything. But, like, Sally is one of the greatest examples.
Oh, I was going to talk about Sally, but I'd point out Don specifically because he is the person that because he is the quote-unquote de facto lead. He is the person we are most likely to label as good or bad, and I think this show very much reveals the uselessness of having those labels and those binaries. And Sally is just an amazing character. Sally, Betty, Joan, and Peggy are queens. They're amazing. But I think the evolution of Sally's character over the course of the 7 seasons has been really fascinating, especially how Matthew Weiner is giving her an immense sense of autonomy, and I think that she will be the first character out of all of them to declare herself a feminist.
I like that. That's a good crackpot theory. I think Sally is kind of, there's always that one character in a TV show where everything is locked in that character and they're kind of like hiding this other subtextual core of the show. I think she's that character. I think the whole like generational thing of Mad Men and how it's something being passed down and it's a historical text, she hides that. But that's getting into a tangent. I want to talk about, you were speaking about Don as being vulnerable earlier and that making Don such a special character. So I think it's time to share with you like my big overarching, like obviously I love Mad Men. I think about it all the time. I'm always trying to approach it with different lenses. And I think it's dangerous to go at a show and be like, this is the thesis of the whole show. But I just want to share something that like, I guess I'm going to float by you. Don's crisis is that he wants to be allowed to be vulnerable. He wants to find connection through that. Peggy's crisis is she wants people to take her seriously. Being vulnerable, specifically in this context, this show's context, historical context. And obviously all shows are made about the time in which they are made, not just about the time in which they take place. It's something that's really associated with being female as an idea. And being taken seriously is something that's really associated with being male. Now,
unless you are a bitch.
Yeah, but then you're just like bossy and you're completely written off.
That's the point. Being taken, like... Bitch is very gender term. Kind of like I'm using that as in a self-aware way. I'm to illustrate this idea that when Peggy is trying to be taken seriously, no one pays attention and they write her off as a bitch because her trying to do the same thing as Don invalidates her. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with Joan.
So obviously, this is a show that's got a lot more about it than gender, but I always love to read it through the gender lens. Yeah. And so realizing that Don wants to be allowed to be vulnerable, which is traditionally a female idea, let me clarify that, and that Peggy wishes she could be taken seriously, which is traditionally a male idea, to me, the show is about the transgender and genderqueer crisis. All of these characters, specifically seen through Don and Peggy, wish they could be genderqueer, wish they could have everything, that they could shed these boundaries of gender and allow themselves to express themselves and be happy. This show is about the transgender crisis. I mean, what do you think? Like,
that is a daring thing to say. That is interesting.
And I think this is a very, very subconscious part of the show. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is necessarily something that's bred into it. I think this is more of the psyche of Weiner and the writers coming out into it. And specifically as a document of our time.
I'm processing.
So here's the amazing thing. Peggy allows Don to be vulnerable. And Don allows Peggy to be taken seriously. That is their relationship. That the whole thing with the whole transfer in Waterloo, he's the reason she gets pushed so high. And she's the only person that he's been able to cry with as a kind of like proxy to mm-hmm. his mother figure of Anna. Mm-hmm. Anna Draper. Mm-hmm. It's the perfect relationship. It's the perfect friendship at the core. They allow each one allows the other to be that genderqueer, to break off the ideas of what gender is in order to be happy. That's such a wonderful and empowering relationship.
I would agree. I think that's interesting. Although I don't think this is the first show to do that. I think the X-Files does that to some degree. Although I'm not well-versed enough in the X-Files to support that claim.
I am not. Not at all.
I think that's a very interesting claim, and I think that's an interesting claim.
And I think that speaks also to the gaze of the show, how the show's gaze fluctuates and how it's so deeply mired in the idea of gender and how it holds us back. I mean, it's the struggle Joan is dealing with. It's the struggle Sally is dealing with. It's the struggle every character on the show is dealing with in some way. We see it most articulate through Don and Peggy.
And I think I also think that makes sense in that the show seems to be very conscious of this idea that identity is a social construct, especially by setting it within the advertising world where they are selling this construct of how to illustrate yourself. Mm-hmm. How to make yourself up, what that mm-hmm. means.
How to aspire to ideals that you can never reach.
Mm-hmm. But I would the other thing that I was thinking of when you said happy, I would honestly argue that there's a part of Mad Men, I guess if you view it in another lens, that argues that happiness does not exist.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But they find some kind of solitude, some kind of feeling of belonging when they can allow themselves to be to fluctuate, to express those feelings that in other, I mean, the best moments, the moments where they feel and the performances of John Hamm and Elizabeth Moss are the best and that the characters seem the most organic are when they are privately together working on something or sharing a moment. Mm-hmm. The hotel room in Waterloo, his office in the suitcase. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've had their troubles, too, I think, of negotiating what their relationship has meant, but that to me is the true insight at the core of the show, or the truest insight I've been able to gather. Mm-hmm. But
there's another piece that I think would be relevant to the conversation that I believe Todd Vanderwolf wrote that's on Vox, and it's about the use of You Only Live Twice in season 5, I believe, and how that is also a way to view all of the characters trying to live double lives. But I think the double life is also relevant in terms of talking about gender. Since that song, although the way that Vanderwolf framed it was as people who were compromising their dreams and their dreams being broken and whatnot, I think that song can also be read as trying to transgress these binaries into becoming something more fluid.
I really like that reading.
I want to say a couple more things because we didn't actually talk about queer characters on the show.
Oh, we totally have to do that.
Sal and Bob Benson, ostensibly.
Bob Benson. Oh, God. I love Bob Benson.
I love his shorts. His shorts are
Yeah, he has a good fashion sense.
And marital rape.
Yeah.
Ugh, there's so much to talk about.
Maybe, so let's pick and choose. I think we should talk about Sal.
We can talk about Sal and Bob Benson, and then maybe devote an entire other thing to Mad Men.
I often forget that Joan's one friend kissed her at one point. Her female
friend. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I forget about that all the time. And then I watch the scene and I'm like, holy shit. I was like, I don't remember this happening.
I can't wait until the complete series is announced for Blu-ray and DVD, because I'm going to buy that so hard.
I'm going to need to buy the first season DVD again.
What
because
happened?
Mine is getting old and decrepit because I've watched it so much. I think people could tell that we fucking love this show. So,
you know, it's problematic.
We should put that in this. I mean, actually, that's a great way to talk about Sal. Mm-hmm. Oh, and also Lee Garner Jr. He was this Lucky Strike executive
who hit on Sal.
Yeah, who got Sal fired essentially. What would you like to say about Sal?
Sal. I miss Sal. The funny thing about Sal, because we're going to talk about Sal now, we're going to talk about actual queer characters on the show, is that when I started watching Mad Men, I texted Connor and I said, is Sal closeted? And Connor gave me some annoyingly ambiguous answer.
I did?
You did.
That dialogue in the first episode, like, the first time I watched it, I didn't completely put it together. The second time, I was like, what the heck? This is so overt, like, what he's talking about, like, when he comes in with this sketch of this guy just reclining shirtless on a hammock. And then Don's like, why don't you draw a girl there beside him? And he's so performative, and he's like, he says something about, like, I can draw a sexy girl. And, like, he says something about, like, he wishes he could be alone with these girls so he can do something to them. Like, he's so trying so hard. But yeah.
And I think that is also indicative of the barriers that exist within the world that all the characters are trying to get rid of, are trying to transcend.
And it's hard to, like, connect sometimes that Sal still exists as an archetype in our world. I did find the character of Lee Garner Jr. actually incredibly refreshing. As a really, I think the shows had, like, I really don't like how they handled Sal in a way of kind of like erasing a queer character from the show completely. Like, I would have liked to follow him in some way if they could have done that, but I think it's had some missteps with how it's handled things, but in general, I think it's done a really good job at complex characters, period, no matter what their orientation or identity.
His thing for Ken, I thought, was very sad, and very well written.
Yeah,
very sad.
Yeah, and that is an identifiable experience no matter what time period you're in.
Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting in terms of how they've handled that later in the series is, before I had watched season 7, I did pick up the Blu-ray set, and on the back it listed the special features and it talked about the queer rights movement. Then I watched the first part of season 7, and I was curious as to why they would include that as a documentary, as a special feature on that set, because that is only ever hinted at once. Any idea of Bob Benson being queer, I think, is only ever explicitly hinted at twice in the show. The part where he comes on to Pete, which may or may not be sincere, but I love that scene anyways. And when he is bailing his friend out of jail.
And he's proposing to Joan. And Joan is like, you're gay.
Yeah.
You can't do this. Like, her subtext of what she's saying is like, stop this. I'm not going to be your beard. I wish there was more, to be honest, like I always do. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't ignore it.
Peggy had that queer friend.
Yeah. I forget her name.
I don't remember her name. But she's played by someone who's on Girls.
Yeah, it's Shoshana.
Yes.
God damn it, we're awful people. We don't know this person's name, the actress' name. But
Zosia Mamet?
Yeah, that's her. That's her.
She's related to David Mamet.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Holy crap. Anyways, tangent. Anything else you want to say about the queer characters?
I wish there were more.
I always wish there were more, though.
Yeah, that's about it.
It's not an excuse, but I think for what it does, it does a good job at the characters that it has. I would want to see more of Zoja Mamet's character, actually. I hope we do actually see her this season. But
I could see Pete being gay.
Oh, I think I read a piece about that. And I think I talked about that with my roommate, too. We had, like, an in-depth discussion. I totally could see that. Or at least repressing some desires. And that would make a lot of sense with his character. And that would be a really cathartic way to see him. That's a good note to end on, I think.
Yeah.
And that is today's media query. Pete might be gay.
And now, what we're late to the game with, where we champion one piece of culture that we're finally getting around to, but love all the same. Connor, what are you late to the game with this week?
So I feel like I would be cheating if I chose Celine Sciamma. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Okay. So I feel like I would be cheating if I chose Celine Sciamma's Tomboy, because I'm nowhere near finished with it, but I was totally captivated by what I saw so far. I can't wait to finish it. Yes, I know I am a horrible person.
If you can do that, then I can do mine.
No. I've got to choose something that I've completed or I'm going to feel awful all week. So I am going to choose something I completed. I'm going to go with Andorra, which is a play that was recommended to me by a playwright and director friend of mine. I only read the actual play. I have not seen it. So it follows a town of these proud nationalists around the time of the World Wars and how they identify this one Jewish man by his Jewishness. And they attribute all these qualities to him. And out of this, there's this sense of foreboding that something really bad happens involving this guy. And out of this whole play, though, there comes this very complex yet elegantly simple statement about how identity is retroactively formed, how we shape our identities, but also how our communities shape our own identities by telling us who we are, and how arbitrary and damaging all of this can be. And that's what I really admired about it. And I recommend it if you can get a hold of it, but it's really obscure. I was reading a translation. I forget what language it is in, but I was reading a translation that was a little shifty, but I really enjoyed it. So that's what I'm late to the game with. How about you?
So what I am late to the game with is David Carson and Brian Fuller's adaptation of Stephen King's Carrie, which was made as a backdoor pilot for NBC in 2002 in the hopes of it being a series. And at first, there isn't much connecting this version of Carrie and Brian De Palma's earlier adaptation from 1978, I believe, with Sissy Spacek and John Travolta and Amy Irving. There's a very strange, glossy quality to the cinematography. It's very shaky and much of it is handheld, and the color timing is kind of bad, but it makes sense. This is a new Carrie for a new generation, and it pulls more from Stephen King's novel than it does from De Palma's adaptation, and there's a real sense of distrust and distress in the camera. It's almost like this neorealism does not actually sense, but almost a hyper-realistic sense of the camera inhabiting Carrie's sense of distress in the world. It's incredibly compelling, and I wasn't expecting it to be so. There are moments when it does nod to De Palma's adaptation, almost recreating that the period scene shot for shot, but then it subverts that very idea and has certain aspects of that scene shot over and over again from different angles, as if to, one, to show this perspective from Carrie's POV, but then from other characters within that same scene, replaying it over and over again as if it's this kind of trauma she has to continually live out again and again. I'm not making much sense here.
No, it makes sense. And I mean, honestly, you hook me whenever you say Brian Fuller on something. So, Yeah, that's just fascinating to me that that happened.
Yeah.
I have not seen it, though, so.
So, yeah, David Carson and Brian Fuller's adaptation of Carrie from 2002. Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely something great. It was just recently released on Blu-ray by Scream Factory, which is their horror, which is Shout Factory's horror division.
Cool. Yeah. So on to feedback. This week, we don't have any direct feedback, but in response to, in kind of like a follow-up with our previous episode about Tinder and Grindr, that whole discussion, for those who are really into it, at least the topics that we broached, which we really want to get to it some other time. And to be honest, when we were recording it, I was like, we are not doing anything special in this episode. And then when I listened to it and I was editing it, Kyle, you brought up so many great points, and I really want to explore them in the future. But Kyle found this really great piece that we'll attempt to link in the show notes, and I'll get to that in a second. We really want you to check it out, though. It's the article is titled "The Demand for Instant Gratification and Embracing Sexual Fantasies in Lieu of Physical Intimacy." So if that didn't attract you to reading it, it's all about like the fantasy we have, how we want to avoid the difficult stuff now. And maybe that's why Tinder and Grindr are so successful, because we have this fantasy of actually staying at home alone and dipping our toe in the water, but not going through all the difficult things of meeting people in person, how we prefer to deal with the sexual fantasy, and we prefer the night scrolling through Tinder alone. It's why they're so elusive and so they cast such a spell over us. It's a really great piece. The only thing is that it's formatted really oddly so that you can't link the actual piece itself. You have to link the page in which, like the blog roll. So it's really odd. I already archived it though, just in case, because I really like some of the points of the piece. But yeah, it's kind of difficult to get to, and it's, it's just formatted oddly, but it's a really great read if you can get to it. So hopefully it'll still be up by then.
And don't forget, if you have any other articles that you think we might find interesting, ideas or topics for future episodes, any comments or feedback, you can send it all to our new Tumblr, mediaquery.tumblr.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes, because then more people will find us and more people will listen, and then it's a win-win for everyone.
And then we'll read your review on the show.
Yeah.
Okay, Kyle, before we let everyone know what next episode's topic's going to be, would you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Awesome. Yes, I can. You can find me on Twitter at Tyle Kerner, T-Y-L-E-K-U-R-N-E-R, because I'm a very creative person. I write about movies on the internet for a bevy of places. But you can find me also as assistant editor of MovieMezzanine.com. Unfortunately, the balcony has closed. May it rest in peace.
Yes, we're very sad about that.
Yes. You can find my collected works of writing at tylekerner.tumblr.com. And this week I've started a column at vaguevisages.com, vaguevisages.com, where I make a case for different movies to be canonized by the Criterion Collection. And I think you should check out my two favorite pieces were on Let the Right One In by Thomas Alfredson, or Tom Alfredson, and William Friedkin's Bug. So check those out at vaguevisages.com. Also, I wrote about Eyes Wide Shut, Wish Fulfillment, and Monogamy at my actual blog, MovieScene, MovieScene.wordpress.com. So you should also check that out. I got an A on it from my professor, so yay!
Vertical integration. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Connor M. Good. That's C-O-N-N-E-R-M Good. I Instagram graphics for the show you're listening to right now, as well as a photo log of the stories I'm currently inhaling. You can find launch pads to everything else I do at ConnorMGood.com, including my Tumblr, theaudienceisthemessage.tumblr.com, where I post my micro musings on media.
Our show is produced by Connor with lots and lots of help from me. Our sumptuous music is You're My Thrill, covered by Voodoo Suite, and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license, which means that Media Query is too.
Woohoo! And if you like what we're up to here on Media Query, slide us a review on iTunes, and please queer the conversation in your own circles.
That's it for today. We're queer, and we'll still be here next time on Media Query.
All right, Kyle, tell our listeners what we're going to be recording for our next episode, which we're actually about to record in like 15 seconds. What are we going to be talking about?
Well, I have a hint for you. They're live, goddammit.
That's good. That's good. Maybe we should just leave it at that.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Pinot Noir.
Yeah. Pinot Noir.
Myanmar.
Do you just want to do the whole thing?
I don't actually know all the lyrics.
I don't either. Oh, my God.
Although I'm not well-versed enough in the X-Files to support that claim.
I'm not at all. Whoa, my voice just did something gross. I'm going to say that again. I am not. Not at all.
What was the gross thing that you're talking about?
Hmm?
I don't know what just happened.
My voice went, ugh! I don't think
you heard. No, it didn't.
It did.
Anyway,
Kyle, you watch things every week. You've got to have something.
Yeah, I have a thing.
Okay, you've got one?
Can it be something I haven't seen in a very long time to the point where it counts as a new viewing? Yes, it is. Okay, don't just yes, nod your head. That's what I'm doing.
I'm shaking my head. Oh, by the way, don't be... I sense your passive aggressiveness about how you're going to break the rules by just going 3, 2, 1, and then reading the thing and confirming with me that you're doing something that is in the rules. You have to choose something that is something that you have not seen that you want to champion. That's the rule. This is serious work, Kyle. We are doing important work here.
Can I tell you what I was going to do?
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to do the television movie of Carrie that was written by Brian Fuller.
Oh, wow. You rewatched that this week?
Yeah, but I haven't seen it since middle school, so I don't count it as having seen it.
But you saw it a while ago.
I saw it like when I was 12.
All right, fine. Do it.
Okay, so what I'm late to the game with...
I might not use it, but do it.
Okay. You can find me on Twitter at Tyle Kerner, T-Y-L-E-K-U-R-N-E-R, because I'm a very creative person. I write about movies on the internet for a bevy of places, but my main homestay is as... You can find me on Twitter at Tyle Kerner, T-Y-L-E-K-U-R-N-E-R, because I'm a very creative person. I write about movies on the internet for a bevy of places, but my main homestay is as... Oh, mother of God.
It's okay.
You can find me on Twitter at Tyle Kerner, T-Y-L-E-K-U-R-N-E-R, because I'm a very creative person. I write about movies on the internet for a number of places, but I'm also assistant editor at MovieMezzanine.com. Sadly, the balcony has closed. May it rest in peace.
Your phone just buzzed?
Ah, mother of God! Hold on.
Yeah, throw it away.
You can find me on Twitter at Tyle Kerner. You can find...
Outtakes!
Our show is produced by Connor with lots and lots of help from Kyle. God damn it! I can't today. I cannot.
Oh, that was funny.